I'm Bill Hemmer, and this is the Fox News Rundown.
Tuesday, February 27th, 2018. I'm Jessica Rosenthal. Questions are being raised about the police response to the Florida school shooting.
There's an immediate assumption that you're supposed to run in with guns blazing, and that's not always the best scenario.
I'm Dave Anthony. The Koreas marched together at the Olympics, and there was talk of unification. Now what?
We should never be surprised by anything that North Korea does.
And I'm Tom Shalhoub. I've got the final word on the Fox News Rundown.
After the Valentine's Day shooting at the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas School in Parkland, Florida, one Broward County Sheriff's deputy, who served as the school resource officer, is being called a coward for his response to the gunfire. But is he? Is that really fair? Former Deputy Scott Peterson failed to enter the school, remaining outside, and a wide range of people have been very critical of that. From his boss, Sheriff Scott Israel.
Devastated, sick to my stomach. There are no words.
To President Trump.
We all learned something when we saw Peterson standing outside of that school. He wanted no part of it. He heard the power and he heard probably the screaming and the bullets, and he wanted no part of it. And then three other guys came to help. They wanted no part of it. That was a terrible, terrible job.
Peterson, who has since resigned from the sheriff's department, is defending himself. He's hired an attorney who lays out in a press release exactly why Peterson, the 2014 School Resource Officer of the Year, responded appropriately here. Now, since the Columbine school shooting almost 20 years ago, it's a general rule. Officers don't wait for SWAT anymore. They're supposed to engage the threat. But there's a lot of nuance there, too. What are responding officers supposed to do?
You know, each circumstance is different. What you're trained to do is to take the best tactical advantage that you can in the situation. And a lot of that, there's an immediate assumption that you're supposed to run in with guns blazing, and that's how you solve the situation.
Robert Pavone is a retired police chief who now runs New York State Crime Stoppers.
And that's not always the best scenario. What an officer needs to do, or officers at the scene, is they need to look and see what tactics the situation is going to require and to implement them. And let me make this analogy. Police officers respond a lot of times to incidents, accidents, things of that nature, with a police car with lights flashing and sirens screaming, and they race to the scene. And one of the first things that we teach rookie cops is that you have to get there to be of any assistance. So you've got to exercise due caution in your response. You can't help anybody if you're on the way to the hospital yourself. So that type of thinking, extrapolate that into these major situations, has got to be really what the baseline is. In this particular instance, where it said that there was a four-minute delay in this deputy's response, four minutes sounds like a long time, but it's really not when you're trying to assess a situation. Now, I can't make a judgment on what this deputy did. It's disheartening to hear people call him a coward. But to look at the scenario, particularly looking at the response from Deputy Peterson's attorney, I can see where those 4 minutes could tick by pretty quickly.
When we look at former Deputy Peterson's attorney statement in his defense, it says that he thought at first it was firecrackers. Then he thought the shooting was happening outside of the building and took up a tactical position in accordance with those thoughts. That his attorney says he had the presence of mind to have the administrators go to the school's video room to look at CCTV cameras to find the shooter. When you read this defense, what do you make of it? What do you think of it?
It's very plausible. It's all very plausible, and it's all very correct. And you got to remember that there's an issue here that each officer, while acting alone, has to develop the best tactics for the situation, also alerting the backup and the dispatches where he's calling in. And also, too, at this time, you don't know what instructions he was given over the radio. If he was in contact with the dispatcher and there was a superior or a supervisor available, he might have told him to do certain things. You don't know these things until the investigation is concluded. And I really think that this guy's become the scapegoat. I mean, if he didn't do what he was supposed to do, then by all means, he's probably going to be included in lawsuits, and you know, as the saying goes, his name will be mud for the rest of his life. But he should be allowed the courtesy, at the very least, of an investigation to determine if his actions were appropriate.
Knowing that this deputy didn't go on campus and those 4 minutes did elapse, is it possible that we learn in a few days or when this investigation is over that maybe you do just find a way onto campus? Maybe you do just move onto campus, or is it more complicated than that? Are there too many other environmental factors that play a role here?
There are literally hundreds of factors that play a role here. It's too simplistic to think that a person could just hear gunshots, charge into the situation, and remedy it. Particularly when it requires assessment and to disseminate information to the dispatcher and to arriving units. There's a lot to go on here, and it's not a cowboy movie. You just don't charge in and shoot the bad guy, and that's it. There's a lot more responsibility than that.
The sheriff did have some strong words. He said this made him sick to his stomach to see that the deputy hadn't moved onto campus. In light of what you just said, and in light of the fact that the sheriff himself has been asked to resign by many people, is this really just sort of a blame game at this point?
Well, I think it's natural for people to want to find a scapegoat, somebody they can blame for an outrageous, horrific event like this. You know, unfortunately, it's not the appropriate way to figure out not only what happened in this situation, but what's going to happen if there's ever a future situation like that. So, I think that maybe everybody should stop pointing fingers for a little while and assess this professional manner. I think that would be better. I think the sheriff, while I have due respect for him and his career, I think he's maybe confusing his political view with his law enforcement view.
We also spoke to John Michael Keyes. He lost his daughter, Emily, in a school hostage situation in 2006 at Platte Canyon High School in Colorado. Her last message via text to her parents was, "I love you guys." So now Keyes runs the I Love You Guys Foundation. He works with schools and law enforcement around the country to talk about training and preparation in the event of a crisis like an active shooter. In Emily's case, she was the only one of six hostages killed, and the shooter killed her just as police blew off the doors of the room she was being held in. Looking at the Parkland shooting, Keyes cautions those who are grieving against blaming law enforcement, especially as they look for answers here, just as he did in his daughter's case.
I also offer one more piece of advice, and that is slow down with it. We lost Emily in 2006, and it was really in 2009 when we started tentatively down this path. And I think we're seeing that going down this path exposes you to darts and arrows. And sometimes they can hurt.
And if these parents are looking to blame somebody and wanting
to... There's one person to blame, and that's the perpetrator.
Okay.
And I think seeing the compassion that the community has brought, the actions of officers, the actions of medics and the fire and the aftermath, all of that, I think, demonstrates that we as a community are stronger than the perpetrator.
And if some parents want to blame this deputy, what would you tell them?
Take a deep breath. In our aftermath, we embrace law enforcement and law enforcement actions. And here I am 11 years later on a path that I wouldn't have anticipated in 2006. And those actions have resulted in the ability to have a credible conversation with law enforcement. Doesn't mean that we should not hold law enforcement accountable. It just means that we need to recognize the environment prior to pointing any fingers.
Mr. Keyes, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Jessica.
This is Tom Shalhoub with your Fox News commentary. Coming up.
The Olympics are over in South Korea, where the North Koreans shared the spotlight. Athletes from both countries even marched under a unified Korean flag. But amid all the talk of possibly better relations, the U.S. is keeping up the pressure on North Korea with
the heaviest sanctions ever imposed on a country before.
Though, as a group of conservatives cheered President Trump at CPAC last week, he added,
and frankly, hopefully something positive can happen. We will see.
North Korea has opened the door to possibly talking to the U.S.
We're moving into a very difficult time in our relations with Seoul.
Gordon Chang is a Daily Beast columnist and Korean expert who wrote a book, Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World.
I believe that the U.S. is starting to look at this in a very nuanced way, and it's actually doing quite well.
Well, the president from South Korea, Moon, says in a statement there's a need for the U.S. to lower the threshold for talks. Do you think that that's a good idea for Washington?
I think it's a good idea in the sense that the most important thing right now is to make sure the alliance between the United States and South Korea, which has kept the peace for decades, doesn't break. And Vice President Pence has already lowered the threshold by saying that we would talk to the North Koreans unconditionally. That was the interview that he gave on Air Force Two as he left South Korea. Now, in general, what the Trump administration is trying to do is essentially to keep the pressure up on North Korea with the sanctions.
Now, last Friday, President Trump added to the sanctions on North Korea that the U.S. and the U.N. have already imposed.
In our campaign of maximum pressure to denuclearize the Korean Peninsula.
The new U.S. punishment targets fuel and energy sources for the North Koreans by targeting 28 ships registered in China and several other countries. The goal is to stop them from delivering shipments to North Korea at sea, ship-to-ship transfers of coal and refined fuel products.
If the sanctions don't work, we'll have to go phase two. And phase two may be a very rough thing. May be very, very unfortunate for the world.
Well, the president has in the past suggested all options are on the table, including the military. Last year, he even warned North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, deriding him as Rocket Man, that the U.S. might have to annihilate his country.
28 vessels were designated, in addition to 27 entities and one individual. That essentially is moving towards a blockade of North Korea. Now, of course, we're not there yet, but nonetheless, that's the way the North Koreans see it. We know the sanctions are already starting to bite, and if we keep the pressure on, then there's no problem with talking with the North Koreans. The only problem is if we do what Moon wants, which is to reduce sanctions in order to, in his view, create this sort of a better environment for talks. But if you reduce pressure, we know what happens. The North Koreans just pocket the concessions and then walk away. What we need to do is increase the pressure so that they realize that they've got no choice but to do what the United States and the international community wants, which means to give up their ballistic missiles and their nuclear weapons. So give them no choice, and then talking with them is not a big deal in a sense.
How well did North Korea do, in your view, diplomatically, politically, getting themselves into the Olympics, sending a delegation? Kim's sister goes to the games. The media goes crazy covering her. It's almost like she's the Ivanka Trump somehow of North Korea. How did North Korea do, in your view?
Well, in the opening ceremony, I think that they did score propaganda points because Kim Yo-jong, the sister of the North Korean ruler, was there. She did, in fact, create a sensation among the South Korean public. But we got to remember that the U.S. countered. Vice President Pence talked about human rights, met with North Korean escapees, went to the Chonan Memorial, which honors the 46 South Korean sailors that North Korea killed in March of 2010. And we got to remember, we had our own sensation, and that was Ivanka Trump, who went to the closing ceremonies. And at the same time, the North Koreans sent the person who is considered to be responsible for killing 50 South Koreans in 2010. That didn't go down very well in South Korea. So whatever propaganda points we lost at the opening ceremony, we more than made up for it at the closing ceremony.
This isn't the first time that the Koreas have talked unification. They held their first post-war talks in 1971, but that effort fizzled. 20 years later, they talked again. Also on the heels of an Olympics in South Korea, they even signed a treaty of reconciliation, trying to formally end the war and reestablish lines of communication, but that effort also broke down, and then North Korea refused to let international nuclear inspectors in, and the U.S. and South Korea resumed military exercises. Then in 2000, another attempt. The two countries held a summit, but that also failed to gain traction amid North Korean missile and nuclear tests.
Many South Koreans don't think they're combinable, and especially younger ones who don't support their president who wants to combine the two Koreas. But the North Korea, from the very beginning of 1948, has had a policy of reunification. In 1950, we saw that what that meant. That was the start of the Korean War. The North Koreans actually are starting to think that their goal of unification is actually achievable. Kim Jong-un, the ruler, has been talking more and more about final victory, quote-unquote. That's North Korean lingo for absorbing the South. And many people worry that South Korea is vulnerable to intimidation. The idea of North Korea taking over South Korea is not inconceivable. And as ludicrous as it sounds, there are some really dangerous trends, including having President Moon Jae-in, who supports North Korea more than he supports the U.S. He's the leader. And although most South Koreans don't like what President Moon is doing, President Moon has the authority and the power to do a lot of things that could damage the alliance. Remember, it's the U.S.-South Korea alliance that has kept the peace on the peninsula since the end of the fighting in the Korean War in 1953. We're basically the only things that prevents North Korea from taking over the South. And so we got to keep that alliance in place despite what President Moon is trying to do.
And these talks and North Korea's push include also their hope that somehow they can drive a wedge and stop military exercises in the country, because they can't stand it when the U.S. and South Korea play war games.
Well, those war games, those drills, which are scheduled to start soon, are absolutely essential to keep the militaries sharp, to be able to prevent a North Korean invasion. The North abhors them, but nonetheless, these drills have continued for decades, and they'll continue as long as the United States maintains its alliance with South Korea. President Moon doesn't like those exercises, but on the other hand, there are a lot of people in the South Korea electorate who don't like what President Moon is trying to do.
We haven't had a missile test of any kind, a nuclear test of any kind from North Korea for almost exactly 3 months now. They had more than a dozen missile tests in 2017. Are you expecting one soon, or are they laying low on that for a little while?
Well, they're laying low for a couple of reasons. First of all, they've got this charm offensive because of the Olympics. They've also got their North Korean military's winter training cycle, which really makes it difficult for them to launch missiles. Also, you've got bad weather. It's cold in the Korean Peninsula, so it's not conducive to missile tests. So you combine all those reasons, you almost always have a lull during the winter months in North Korea's missile and nuke testing. But, you know, at this point, we're heading to spring. March is when they start to resume their testing. Whether they'll test or not, I have very little idea, just because they have a lot of reasons why they should test, and there are a lot of reasons why they shouldn't test. And I don't know how Kim Jong-un is going to sort all of that out. But, you know, we should never be surprised by anything that North Korea does, because they do have the capacity, because they think differently than we do, they do have the capacity to keep us off guard.
Gordon Chang, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Download and subscribe to original podcast from Fox News Radio.
It's time to get caught up on what's happened and what's next. I'm Jared Halpern from Washington.
Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcast.com.
It's time for your Fox News commentary.
Tom Shalhoub.
What's on your mind?
So California is considering banning plastic straws.
Not an outright ban, but legislation that would prohibit restaurants from providing straws to customers unless they ask for one. Apparently, we throw away billions and billions of these straws every year, and they end up in the ocean. Now, my first reaction to government regulation from environmentalists is usually, come on, stop trying to tell us how to live our lives all the time. But then I gave it a second thought, and I started to wonder, what do we really need all these straws for anyway? Every fast food restaurant in America has a massive canister of straws, and we grab them and stick them into our drinks without thinking much about it. But let's face it, straws are for kids. We're adults. We're perfectly capable of lifting a cup to our face and tilting our arm so the beverage enters our mouth. Oh, but I need a straw, you say, for my car, so I can sip while I drive. Well, I don't really think you should be drinking that beverage in your car either. I can't talk on my cell phone. I don't know why you should be allowed to have a big gulp in your hand. Some people do need a straw, for instance, someone with a physical disability. But for the rest of us, I think we can suck it up and do without them. I'm not for the government telling us what to do, but perhaps we can all agree on this without legislation and just collectively wean ourselves from the mass-produced, overused plastic straw. There. I guess I'm an environmentalist. I'm Tom Shalhoub.
You have been listening to the Fox News Rundown. Stay up to date by subscribing to Fox News Radio's hourly newscast at foxnewspodcasts.com. And for up-to-the-minute news, visit foxnews.com.